The topic is hoping without hope. And I'd like to talk for a little bit about really the reasons for which there is no hope in life. And then talk a little bit about the underlying reason why there is no hope in human existence. And then try to reconstruct something like an experience of hope for us. And what does it mean to have hope when there is no hope? Now, it's a dire situation to which I speak. And Tom said it with devastating simplicity just now when he said that 100% of individuals here are suffering or are going to suffer. Doesn't mean you are all suffering, although many more of you are suffering intently than might appear to be suffering intently. But for the very small minority of you who are not suffering intently, you will later, or you did before. And you have to be funny about this because it is so powerful. There is a cycle of defeat in the human condition that is rooted in human nature. Human nature is the great constant. It never has changed. It's never changed in the history of the world. I'm open to it changing later, but it has so far not changed. David showed in a very rangy, thoughtful breakout yesterday on HBO, showed a little clip from an HBO show called Girls. I think it was from Girls. And in it, the young woman protagonist is very involved in an inner struggle about sex, men, boys, future, despair, depression, and she's tweeting. And the camera spends quite a bit of time on her face as she is intently focused on her tweets. And it's brilliantly conceived because everything bad and malicious and self-involved and self-assertive and threatened and fearful and focused in animus and also in deep terror is summed up in the sort of 3 minutes that the camera shows her furiously tweeting. And as you watch it, you say to yourself, despite the technology, despite the fact that she is living through a screen rather than living in unmediated relationships, it's human nature, and it's vicious, and it's in terror, both at the same time. It's incredibly defensive, unbelievably anxious, and deeply self-involved. And it was such a picture of human nature in 2012 that is so exactly the same as it was at the Battle of Pharsalia when Pompey was defeated by Julius Caesar. It's simply, instead of looking at the head of Pompey in a basket, it's a young woman desperate for love in a little horrible, alienating apartment in 2012. But it's the same basic, profoundly self-involved and self-focused threatened human being. Now, the powerful is this defeat because it is ultimately rooted in the fear of death. Death is the great issue of human existence. In fact, the great human issue is not control or even acceptance. The great, the big kahuna of human experience is the universal fact of death. The Onion had that headline not long ago. Mortality rate appears to be holding steady at 100%. Statisticians are hoping for a drop in the mortality rate to perhaps 92, or a more reasonable would be to 95%. But thus far, it's holding at 100%. And the real reason why life is without hope, vis-a-vis our sort of autonomous ego self, is that we all face its extinction, qua the self that we know now. What did REM say? It's the end of the world as we know it. And that's why death is an intolerable fact. It's intolerable. Now, I want to talk for a minute about Julie Andrews. One of the most interesting things in Hollywood history is the transformation late in her career of Julie Andrews from Mary Poppins and Chim Chim Cheree, which I happen to think is a great movie, and How Do We Solve a Problem Called Maria, to the hero of the heroine of SOB, her husband Blake Edwards' shocking, hostile movie, SOB. It's so shocking and so hostile that everybody, it was a failure. Or Victor Victoria. Or most interesting to me, the death annotated version of the song that Julie Andrews sings in the catastrophic Hollywood flop called Darling Lily. Now, none of you have ever seen Darling Lily except by mistake. It cost $35 million to make in the 1970s or early 80s, and it almost bankrupted Paramount Studios. In one fell swoop, Paramount Studios almost went out of existence because of Darling Lily. Darling Lily is a kind of brilliant love song to Blake Edwards, the director and writer and producer's second wife, Julie Andrews. And what is so shocking about Darling Lily, and you can go on YouTube the entire movie, because now that YouTube has changed its rules, you can do 2 hours and 24 minutes. It's a terrible movie. It is way too long. You can see all the money they spent for naught. And yet it has a beginning that is 3 minutes and 29 minutes that is the essence of why there is no hope in human existence. And it's Julie Andrews who plays a German spy who's English singing a song called Whistling Away the Dark. Now this song, in fact, got an Academy Award nomination, and Whistling Away the Dark, and it was written by Johnny Mercer. I want to talk about Johnny Mercer in just a minute, who is a devout Episcopalian, grew up in Christchurch, Savannah, and I have learned a lot about him recently. But he didn't just write The Sweetheart Tree. He wrote Whistling Away the Dark. Now what is so powerful about this is that this shows that underneath all of that which is hopeful and good, humanly speaking, such as Mary Poppins, there lies another Julie Andrews, whose husband got her to sing Whistling Away the Dark. And not only did he get her to sing it, he has her conclude the movie with the entire recap, except this time there's a difference that is much worse. Now, Whistling Away the Dark, and you can YouTube it right now, 3 minutes and 29, she's in complete blackness. And all you see is Julie Andrews' face singing about, we are all facing the dark. The dark, by which she means explicitly death, is coming. So all we can do is whistle, I whistle a happy tune, but that's not the song. I whistle, and I'm not whistling in the dark. I'm whistling away the dark, temporarily, by a false veneer of happiness, but I want you to be with me. It's a love song to my companion in the approaching finality of death. It's an extremely heavy moment, partly because it's Julie Andrews, you know, I could have danced all night, and here she's whistling away the dark. And the thing about it is, she means it. And it's a love song because she's singing it ultimately to Rock Hudson, who's the co-star. Because even though they're facing death, she knows that it's better to whistle away the oncoming blackness of the dark death together rather than alone. Now, that is a basically represents the fact that life is impossible, not because of our failed efforts, but because of the universality of the termination that death expresses, even in Christian terms, to us as we are now. Now that you'll admit, right? And I'm a Christian. But the us that is here now, when was the last time you were at a funeral home and somebody you loved or someone you knew was lying in the casket? Raise your hands emotionally if any time recently you've been at a funeral home and you've been with somebody whom you knew, and they, you know, the Episcopal Church until recently had a lot of rules about things and have all gone down the boards. But if you wanted to get an Episcopal rector of Christ Church Charlottesville, let's say, really mad in 1965, don't deny the Trinity. Just have an open casket. Because it was one of those things that Episcopal clergy were unbelievably arrested about. They had a point. Because when you have an open casket, which is now universal, I've not been to a funeral for 15 years where there wasn't an open casket the night before. What do you immediately know? She's not there. Now, she may be somewhere else, but you know instinctively, he's not there. I mean, whoever's there is not my mother. Because it's instinctive. You know it automatically. It's an unarguable truth that the person that you loved is not there. Something is there, but it's the end of the world as we knew it. Her false teeth are there. Her cancer-ridden body is there. The hands that caressed you are there. Perhaps even the clothing that she wore when she was on the altar guild are present. But she's not there. And so the reason why hope is... there is no hope. And this is such important news to people. There is no hope because we are all facing the extinction of the world as we know it. Our wives, our children, our parents. Do you know that everything that you own will be sold by your children in a yard sale? I mean, really, I have a series of special books that I happen to love. I call it my golden shelf. It's about 50 books behind my where I have about 5 DVDs, a whole bunch of books, some pictures of people that I love, but mostly books and articles that have meant a great deal to me over 60 years. Even those will go into a yard sale. I mean, a few of them may, one of our children or grandchildren may have an affection for the Frank Langella Dracula, for example, that I have behind me. But they may have a modest affection. But even the things that I love the most are going to end up in a yard sale, 5046 North Dillard Street, Saturday, 9 to 3. Now, if you don't think I'm telling you the truth, you have another thing coming. But you won't be there. Now, we talk about death and hope and living hopefully on account of death, which is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to bring you to a place that, for me at least, has been the crux and the origin of hope. And real hope. But I'm going to take you there through death, but I'm going to try to take you there in a non-facile way. Because people talk about death a lot. You have to die to such and such. I have to die to the relationship I used to have with my son. I have to die to a certain kind of expectation I had of my husband. How many times can he disappoint me without my finally realizing that he's never going to change? I have to die. People will say, well, you have to die to that hope. He's just never going to change. And it's easy. The trouble with that is it sort of becomes a conflict. It sort of becomes like a struggle. If I could only die to this desire that he would change. If only I could die to a particular idea I had about my career. or my marriage or lack of a marriage, if I could die to something about me that I cannot seem to lick. But that, you see, becomes a struggle. And as soon as it becomes a struggle, it becomes a conflict structure. And the thing about life is that you cannot win. There's no area that you can really win. Even people who appear to win, like Julie Andrews in the movie, has to sing the song. You know, it's better to whistle away the dark together rather than alone. But the dark will come to her and to me. And so I want to try to talk in more concrete terms briefly about the transition to death and without hope. Now, what have I said so far? I've simply said that life is without hope, primarily because of the clay of human nature. And I use the example of the woman in Girls, who reflects truly where the world is. And this woman is completely captivated by all sorts of ideas about life that are fueled by her will. And the human will is devastatingly bound to fail because it cannot control your will. I cannot control anyone else. But the underlying reality of the problem with the Battle of Pharsalia and, what was that, 59 B.C.? For some reason, I think that James Fishwick will know the answer to that, but somebody here will know it. It was Rex Harrison played it in the movies. The picture in the clay of human nature in Girls or in anything you've ever seen in our lives means that we would be fools to have hope where the rubber hits the road. I mean, he may change in this area because he gets loved. She may change, she may get more confidence in that area because she finally has someone who loves her as she is. And you can always tell when a person is being loved as they are. Some of you I've noticed, who I know well, I've noticed as soon as I see your face, I say, he has a girlfriend. He must. I don't know why, I don't know how, but something has changed because there's a, whenever anyone is loved, you can see it a mile away. It happens in 5 seconds. So you can change in some ways, but the fact that everybody sitting here, and I'm the worst offender, has some kind of pattern that you cannot shift. I mean, try as you might over 30 years, you cannot seem to change this thing about yourself that you do not like. And that tells you that at least in that area, there is no hope. One of the most astonishing things is the way that people who have made huge progress in life can slip on a banana peel in their 70s. I don't know if you've ever noticed this with really old people, but sometimes when they get Alzheimer's, they develop a new vocabulary. And all of a sudden, somebody that's precious to you, who's 84, suddenly develops a very precious vocabulary of four-letter words. And she's female, and she's 85, and she was the president of the Altar Guild. And she was a wonderful person. And all of a sudden, you hear words coming out of her mouth that you haven't heard since you were in the military. And you say a couple of things. Whence got this woman this wisdom? Her speech tells me that she is from Galilee. And how could it have been hidden all those years? How did I not know her to know that these thoughts were actually present but simply bound up? And believe me, everyone here who's ever dealt with older people who get dementia has encountered this pattern. And it's very shocking. So all that means is that there was something there that was never healed. So that shows you, or even I've seen even people who were very normal and did not have disease in their 70s. I've actually seen men in their 70s leave their wives of 50 years. Now, you may say that could never happen. But in fact, many of you know people who have been married for 40 years who suddenly decided that they had a little chance at happiness and they were going to grab at it, even if it was only 5 years. So that tells you that there's really no hope, at least in that area. And the underlying problem is death, because the onset of the bourn from which no traveler returns. I'm only aware of two people who have ever come back from death. One is Lazarus, and he didn't like it. Anatole France wrote a brilliant short story about Lazarus in his 60s. He was very upset. And Jesus Christ. Those of you, there's nobody in the Muslim religion that I'm aware of in that sense that was corporeally reanimated. Obviously, mummy movies, but they're a wonderful exception. Now, the real issue is Judy Garland. Julie Andrews. Because Judy Garland was much more consistent. I once baptized a little baby whose godmother was Liza Minnelli. And in the church, this happened many times in our ministry, things like this would happen. And out of this huge limo in Westchester County emerged the star of Cabaret. And I saw her and I couldn't resist. I had all my clericals on. She got out and I said, maybe this time I'll be happy. And she just looked at me with such, oh, she said, you're the kind of clergyman that I like. The issue of Julie Andrews, listen, this is irreducible. If you can't explain how Julie Andrews could sing twice with total conviction the song Whistling Away the Dark that was written for her, tuned by Henry Mancini, you cannot explain life. Therein lies the course of civilization. That such a thing could be possible. It's like the Beach Boys that David talked so compellingly about. How could they write the song, God Only Knows, and write the song, Vegetables? It's an impossibility unless life were both without hope and also extremely quixotic. Now, the answer to life without hope is death. But really death in a way that is actually is what it claims to be. I want to quote from a recent interview that meant so much to me. I cannot tell you. I've been carrying it in my clothing for the last week. And it is an interview with Bob Dylan in the new Rolling Stone magazine. Now, this interview is very, very frustrating for the interviewer because Bob Dylan absolutely and vexatiously refuses to answer the reporter's journalistic, superficial questions on their own terms. He absolutely resists. So powerful is he in his own, what we today say, his own skin, that he totally is able not to play ball with an interviewer who wants him to declare who his presidential candidate is and what he thinks about various imagery in his songs and what he thinks about possibilities of plagiarism and all these things. But Bob Dylan forces this reporter, who is really very unwise. I'm glad I'm not married to that reporter. Because he's approaching life in a highly superficial sort of what is, or what I see is way that creates foolishness in the persona. Bob Dylan says the following, after sort of resisting this man's questions for, 2,000 words. Bob Dylan says, so when you ask some of your questions, you're asking them to a person who's long dead. You're asking your questions to a person who doesn't exist. Now, that's a direct quote. You're asking your questions to a person who's long dead. You're asking them to a person who doesn't exist. Well, I want to give a maxim based on what he said, and then I want to give a kind of, interesting enough, I want to go as far as I feel I can go at this point in my ministry to giving you a kind of a tool or a how-to for dying in life. but not a struggle. Because if it's a struggle, you'll lose. You know, I'm dying to self. I'm just dying to self. I'm dying to this idea that I ought to have such and such. I'm dying to this idea that she ought to be such and such a way. I'm dying to this idea that I should get a job over there, or that my gifts, you know, that my gifts ought to be used. You know, here I am sitting pretty, and no one's calling on me, and I have all these gifts, right? I have to die to that. And you know, you never will. You'll never succeed. Partly because of death, and partly because it's too big a thing. You cannot win. So I'm going to give you a sort of practical thing about dying that has worked for me, because I think the thing to do, you want to be both dead and alive, like Leonard Cohen. That's an insider joke. But the only life that is hopeful is a life that is dead, but not in a facile or failed or incomplete way. You don't burn off 80% of yourself. You've got to die in the complete sense that I'm going to talk about. Let me put it one way. Paul Zoll, that's in quotes, has got to go. It's not a better Paul Zoll or a tweaked Paul Zoll. Whenever you hear the word tweak, run as far away as you can. It is based on a totally false view of the human problem. Because the ego wants to think that we can tweak. I could just tweak, you know, my sartorial approach. Somebody was saying today, you know, the one thing you should never wear is brown. If you're a clergyman. It was sort of a... there's a lot of background in that comment, but I thought to myself, but you know, a person who really has died just won't wear brown. Now, what we want to talk about, the whole Paul Zoll, you might say, has got to go. Now, I had a potential crack at this, the death of Paul Zoll, about 18 years ago, that I unfortunately missed my opportunity. I was giving a speech somewhere at a highly sought-after venue in the Christian church. It was a venue that was considered to speak there is the biggest feather in the cap for a, let us say, an Episcopalian clergyman. But let us, we all have our form of that. You know what I mean? There's a particular apex of something that might, you know, most of the people I know think they want to become eye bankers at a firm that is called Goldman Sachs. Now, you and I know that Goldman Sachs is bound to fail and go bankrupt in the next 10 years by definition. Not because of anything related to Goldman Sachs. By definition. Because everything does. I mean, you know, quote, too big to fail? That's not true. You know? I want to be too small not to fail. But I was giving this speech at this, which I had really worked on, and in the audience was the 102nd Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, this was not George Carey, who's the 103rd Archbishop of Canterbury. This was his, actually it was the 101st, his predecessor minus two, the 101st Archbishop of Canterbury, was named Donald Coggan. Known to us as Lord Coggan. You know, Americans just eat this stuff up. And I went up to him, because I knew him. I happened to know Lord Coggan. And I gave this speech that I thought was just great. And it featured the B-52s. So I thought it was really cool, as well as inspired. And I went up to Lord Coggan, whom I did in fact know. So I could ask this question, but I never should ask the question. And he did not give me a don't ask, don't tell. I said, Lord Coggan, what did you think? Said he. I went up to him and said, what did you think? And he said, well, if we could just have heard less of Paul Zoll, we might have gotten somewhere. You know, I'm a 44-year-old person at a particular point in life. I am what the world thinks is at the top of their game. That's another phrase. Whenever you hear it, the next day that person will be blown up. If you ever find you're hearing someone saying, I'm at the top of my game, I can guarantee you, because nothing fails like success. And he gave me a crystal clear opportunity to die and to become a new man, which I did not take. I was furious, resentful, angry. Who the heck is he? I wrote him off. That's the last time I'll ever talk to him. And what is he? Who gave, you know, all the things you might think? But he was so cataclysmically correct that, you know, 18 years later, I said to someone, golly, damn, you know, he's dead now, but I wish I listened. Now, what we find is that we have to go out of existence, sort of like The Who, you know, the rock and roll group The Who, but they took the, they're always going back to reunions, because it's I, the person that I am navigating around this building, has to go out of existence because of two reasons. He's going to go out of existence, and he's going to be in an open casket, you know, down in Florida at some point. And he's not going to be there. But what he thought was important, you know, like his weight and his look and his paunch and his glasses and his scars and his hair and his all his things, that's going to be there. And he needs to face that fact. Because when it suddenly happens, he's going to be unprepared. You know, that's why people die badly. They're never prepared. Like maybe 1% of 1% of people that I've ever buried. I've only buried about 1,000 people personally buried. Maybe 1,000 is too strong, but no less than 500. And many of you who are in the ministry have buried hundreds of people. I hate to think how many people Dave Johnson has buried. He's a minister here in Charlottesville. People used to always say, I want you to bury me. They would always say that. And I said, I hate you saying that. But what does it mean? What is the ars moriendi? What is the art of dying? And yet, obviously, we're still here. You know, how can I be, quote, the person that I am, and be a father and a grandfather, and most importantly for me, because that's the person whom I, in a sense, owe the most, a loyal, faithful, loving, comforting husband? How can I be those things? And yet live in death. Well, I'm going to, my last point, and I'm going to end up in about 12 minutes. I want to talk just for a second about what the key to living as a dead person is. And there are two keys to it. I want to talk briefly about a movie that you can see on YouTube tonight. It's just been released on the Criterion Collection. So it's high class foreign movie. And it's been released, and no one saw it since it came out in 1921. But you can see the whole movie tonight on YouTube in the Criterion beautiful new print. And the movie is called The Phantom Carriage. And the movie describes the essence of what I want to invite you to become, which you can only become through the situation that will catapult you into death, the kind of thing that Tom West, the sort of pitch of crisis about which Tom was speaking, the sort of pitch, you know, the woman that I knew that her husband had been with her through her breast cancer, and he was in his late 50s, and she was in her late 50s, and she came from a very distinguished old American family, and he was a very successful kind of guy in a big city in America. And after she came through her illness, and he'd been so great, he'd been in the room every single night, and finally at home in Westchester somewhere, 2 weeks after she finally got home, and they were both in their early 60s, and she finally was able to know that she was well. And he told her, well, honey, I'm so sorry to have to tell you. And I waited till you were all right. But I've been in love with my assistant at work for the last 12 years. And I'm leaving you to get married to her. And it's an irrefutable decision. Well, you don't want it to happen like that. And believe it, there are people in this room, I feel certain, only statistically, who have known people for whom such a shock has come that you just can't. Like bridges at Madison County. You know, you can't believe that your mother really wrote those letters. My mother? You know, she really did that. But it's not my mother, it's my wife, you know, or my husband. when that happens, what has to happen to you is, and it's brilliantly wonderful and significantly the only way forward that I know of now, is what happens to David Holm in a movie called The Phantom Carriage. Now, please don't tune out. I'm not going to give you a long, big movie that you can't see, because we couldn't rent it. But it's all that happens. It's made in 1921 by a very wonderful Swede named Victor Sjöström. And he directed it and starred in it. And it's an unusually naturalistic silent movie. You know, usually in silent movies, Lillian Gish is going around going, you know how silent movies are. They're emoting because they can't talk. But for some reason, the director directed the actors, of whom he was the main one, in 1921, in a naturalistic manner. And David Holm is a spouse abusing a wife beater who is on New Year's Eve, has left home and his two little girls, and he's drinking, and he's an impossible alcoholic. He is absolutely the gutter alcoholic who is responsible for destroying physically and in every sense the life of his wife and potentially his two children. And he has a fight in a cemetery on New Year's Eve, a drunken fight with two other homeless tramps, and he is murdered. And his real, you might call it his soul, arises from his body and accompanies the angel of death in a carriage, a disreputable carriage, we would call it the rag and bone man's carriage, around this little town in Sweden, collecting the dead souls and bodies of men who have died, all the women and men who have died. And as an act of kindness, death allows the hero, David Holm, who's now dead, to accompany him and to see what's going on in his house. And he, who's dead, and this is done by means of superimposition. And you know what superimposition is? It's when you can't use CGI effects because you don't know what they are, right, in 1921. So you film a guy who's watching something, and then you film the scene that he's watching, and then you print them over each other so it looks like both things are happening. But because it's superimposed, the first image looks like a ghost. You've seen this in old Topper movies. Remember Topper movies? Thank God for you. So the ghost is Casper the Friendly Ghost. It's a... Well, he is forced to watch the suicide of his wife, who's quite young. She's about 40. I mean, she's young. She's not about to die naturally. And he is forced. It's an uncommonly upsetting scene for 1921. And by the movie is fused in Christianity. It's all about the resurrection of the man. But he is forced to watch his wife commit suicide with poison and poison their two daughters. He's forced to watch this because he's dead and he can do nothing about it. It's not like Scrooge, who was forced to watch things, remember, that were happening in the present, or that would happen, but that he might be able to affect. Do you remember? What can I do, O angel of Christmas future? He's dead. Scrooge is not dead. Scrooge is sleeping. This man is dead. And it's interesting, when I watch that, I sometimes see moms heavily identified with children. It comes with being a mother. But as you watch it, you say to yourself, why does she need to have to feed poison to her little children as well as herself? Why can't she commit suicide herself because she's feeling suicidal and leave her children alive? But I realized, I thought about that woman that drowned her children in South Carolina. Do you remember? And often this happens, moms who are experiencing depression. You've seen many examples. I'm sure there's ones in Virginia. I do know that Virginia is a special place, by the way, and it is for lovers. What do you make of the, why do they always take their children with them? Because they're overly identified with their children. They somehow think that their children are them. And this man who's dead is forced to watch his wife feed poison to her two children, two little girls, a little boy and a little girl, and herself. And he's forced to watch this as a ghost. It's superimposed. Now, interestingly enough, what's happening in him? Now that he's dead, he sees everything. Now that he's dead, he sees the truth. He sees that his wife was wonderful. He sees that his wife meant him only good. He sees that his wife backed him up for 20 years. He sees that the children were the one hope of a love that they once had. It only takes death for him to see the truth about his life. Now, what this means is the word in sort of currently that you is often used is the word disattach. I don't want to use the word detach because that smacks of certain schools of thought that sound like, isn't there a store in this city that's really a grocery store but with the name yoga in it? What's it called? What? Can you give me a break? I don't want to use the word detach because it has some associations that I don't need to enjoy. Many of our churches will be yoga parlors, you know. And all you need to go is go to Schenectady, New York, and you'll see about 15 churches that are now yoga centers, you know, and churches. But what you find, he is forced to disattach by the reason of death. And the moment he disattaches from David Holm or Paul Zoll, he sees everything as it is. And you, as the viewer, have to watch this man who has been completely cured. He is completely cured. He is in his right mind about everything he sees because he has been detached by death from an attachment that had created resentment, hatred, bitterness, jealousy, malice, murder, and addiction. So, the answer to, if you want to summarize what Paul Zoll is attempting to say, it is that the answer to how you die in a non-facile and a non-conflict structure doomed to fail way is you have to get superimposed. I'm looking at you right now. I'm looking at everyone here. What I see as I look at you is I see you, but superimposed sitting next to you. I see the you, the very person I'm looking at, she's dressed like you, same age, all that, but I see, you might say, you in your right mind. Not with that, with all the garbage of resentments and feelings and baggage and anger and things that you hold against the world and ways of looking at life that are entirely projections and the way clergy are always father figures as opposed to real people and the way mothers are always innately terrible or women, you know, you don't really like women very much because you may have known a woman in your earlier life and so all of a sudden you're constantly projecting your feelings about some other woman on this wonderful woman or maybe you really are scared of men. You know, you're really deep down, you're frightened to death of men, especially when they raise their voice. Ooh, don't! You just can't stand the man when he raises his voice because you had a father who raised his voice at you. I'm talking about, that's you. That's the person I'm looking at. But next to you, I'm seeing superimposed you. And that is a person who is completely in her right mind, totally without all this garbage and inner dynamics of fruitless and futile, projected, transferential, idiotic, futile feelings. And that person sees everything. That person sees that this person over there is really a sweetheart. That person over there who seems so uptight is really just shy and scared. Or that person out there who really seems abusive and difficult and uses profane language is really, he's just been drinking. So he's a Saturday morning out drunk, you know what I mean? There are quite a few of those in the state that is for lovers. Now, and they're more Sunday morning alcoholics. Believe me, in Charlottesville and Richmond, they are thick on the ground. I can say that from experience. And Lexington, well, that's the last word. Now, what I want to say is, the answer to my question is how do you die in a non-facile and not doomed to fail conflictual manner? You die by getting in touch with the superimposed you, who's right there. They're double the number of people in this church right at this moment. And that's the Ebenezer Scrooge part, but unfortunately, Dickens, there's a slight element of superficiality in A Christmas Carol, because it doesn't account for the fact that, that Scrooge relapsed. He had to have relapsed. There is no world in... The world does not exist in which Scrooge didn't get infinitely better, but didn't relapse, because he was dreaming and not dead. Dickens didn't have quite the insight to kill Scrooge, although he came extremely close at the end. Whereas Victor Sjostrom, in, by the way, it's based on a novel by the first woman Nobel Prize winner. Who was that? Lagerlöf. Selma Lagerlöf. She was the first woman to ever win the Nobel Prize. But anyway, she was. She was an ardent feminist, but she was also possessed of a kind of Babette's Feast type of Christianity. And in the story, she realized that for David Holm to come to his senses, he had to die literally. Now, how the story ends, I'm not going to tell you. But I heartily recommend you see The Phantom Carriage sometime in the next week on YouTube for free, or go to Barnes & Noble. I've seen it. It's there right now. One copy. The final thing I'm going to say, and thank you for listening, the final thing I'm going to add, and it is important, it's not a postscript or a coda. How do you find it in yourself to have a conversation, that horrible word that for me has been tainted forever since Friday Night Lights, when Tammy was always telling her daughter that we need to have a conversation? You know, whenever anybody says to me, I think we need to have a conversation, what are they really saying? I'm going to criticize you. The way we used to say is, I have a bone to pick with you. But today, because we can't make a value judgment, even though we have a value judgment, we say, Tammy says to her daughter, honey, we need to have that conversation. You know, oh, I mean, who doesn't want to run screaming out of the room? And who doesn't? What does she do? She gets in her car and leaves. Now, my point is, fact as we conclude, the other, and it's very short, vital factor, how do you have a conversation with the superimposed you who's sitting there in the pew? How does that conversation happen? Well, it only happens in one way and one way only. It happens through consulting a religious psychologist. And that's the last point of the talk. You can't, if I were a bolder, I would say you have to go into therapy. Now, people don't like that. They don't want to hear that. So I won't say it. So I'll try to find a way that you can hear what I'm saying. You have to talk to an individual about it. Now, AA does this instinctually with sponsors and going through the 12 steps. It's instinctive wisdom on the part of Bill W. But you know, he didn't get that wisdom from totally himself. He got that wisdom from Gerald Hurd, who was a weird kind of California English expatriate. And he got it from his own death. He got it from a Catholic priest in Pittsburgh. It was profound life wisdom that was written into the nature of reality. You cannot talk to the superimposed Paul or Mary or Bill or whoever it is without help from an individual. Let me repeat this. You cannot do it yourself. Cannot, cannot, cannot. And there are no exceptions. I invite you to think that you're an exception. I do not consult a therapist, because you will have to, whether through the court system or through court-appointed. But I use the word today, religious psychologist, because I think what the world needs now is religious psychologists. People like Paul Walker and Dave Johnson and Dave Zoll and John Zoll and many others whom I know. I know many of you who are attempting to be religious psychologists. The world needs psychologists who understand about the superimposed self. They understand that the futile battle to change yourself is a cannot be won. And even if you did win it, you would have lost. Like ABBA, I feel like I win when I lose, remember, in Waterloo? That was a red herring. You need a religious psychologist. And if you don't have one, you will never win because because the battle is doomed to failure from the beginning. There is no way that the South could win the Civil War. Now, I'm not making any political judgments about that. Like all young boys, I identified with the Confederates, right? There was no way they could win for two reasons. They didn't have enough men. They just didn't have enough people. The Yankees had five times as many male members of the population. And also, one was industrialized and one was agrarian. And there was no way that that it could not be a lost cause. And you can go back and forth at me. I'm obviously pro. Yeah, I mean, look at Captain Davis, CSA, in that window. This is the world of the Confederate States of America. But anyone looking as the superimposed Jefferson Davis? No way. You need to consult a religious psychologist in order to begin to disattach from the Paul Zoll world, or your world, which is extraordinarily like in a dream. When I consult my religious psychologist, I have a religious psychologist. I've had one for many years. And when I talk to this person, I always feel I'm in my right mind. And after I am talking to him for about 20 minutes, I always say to Mary, you know, how did I get back into that way of thinking? You know, the last 4 days, how come I got so totally in my head? All of a sudden, I began to see everything wrong. But when I talk to this guy, it's like the insanity clears. Christopher Isherwood, the notorious British novelist, who I regard as a genuinely religious man, wrote that even in his late mid-70s, he would become insane until he got grounded enough after talking to his religious psychologist, took some deep breaths, and would then go out and write a great book. So, you've heard me? No hope, short of real death, but the moment you die, in the David Holmes sense, your superimposed self is absolutely ready to live. But the only way you can really ever find her or him is to be in a conversation with another person who is a religious psychologist. And that is the conclusion of my talk, and I thank you so much.